Okay, good morning. Can people hear in the back? Is it okay? You can hear? So often I go places and the sound system doesn't work. Yeah, they always have to fiddle with it, so I'm very impressed with this one. It's so far away. So I always tell people the only place I go where the sound system works first, except for here, is when I go to speak in prisons. The sound systems there always work. The prison system does not work, but the sound system works. Yeah. Okay, so we're here for our vacation with the Buddha this weekend, having a retreat, so it's a very nice opportunity. If I can suggest, you know, really let's try and keep the retreat atmosphere. And so in the break times, don't chat too much. Or if you do talk, talk about the Dharma, you know, not about sports and TV and these kinds of things, okay? And similarly, when you go home this evening, you know, even though we end here at 5 o'clock, try and keep that retreat feeling. If you can do, you know, a meditation session or study session this evening, that's good. And tomorrow morning, you know, before you come here, that's also good. Yeah, because as much as we kind of keep the Dharma in our minds and in our lives, that much benefit we receive from what we're doing. Okay, so this weekend we're going to be working with Living with an Open Heart. I think that's the title. So I'll be talking a little bit about living with an open heart. When was it? Let's see, it was 2 weekends ago. My whole sense of time is very strange now on this tour, you know. So it was 2 weeks ago. I was in Frankfurt, and they also had the weekend program was about living with an open heart. So we started talking about this book. You know, and I was just picking out some ideas from starting at the beginning and going along, talking about the cultivation of compassion and so on. And of course, we didn't get very far. It was only 2 days. And then this, you know, here is the same thing. So I thought I would start from where I left off in Hamburg. And the place where I start is very interestingly a direct follow-up from last night's talk, you know, talking about anger. And so it'll flow very nicely. And so that way my idea is that the people in Frankfurt can hopefully watch the videos that you're making here, and that you people can go back and watch the videos from the Frankfurt teachings that started at the beginning of the book. Okay, and you know, I don't know how far we'll get here. So we may have to continue at another time, okay? But whatever we can do is good. Also, this book, this one was published in the UK, and so I don't think there's a Danish translation, but if as a group you order copies from the UK publisher, it's now under Little Brown Publishers in UK. Then they'll probably give you a discount of some sort. It was written as a secular book, you know, for people who, you know, aren't necessarily Buddhist. It has Buddhist ideas. Actually, the part I wrote mostly is it's plagiarized from the Buddha, you know, talking about how to develop bodhicitta and some of the bodhicitta meditations. And then my co-author, Russell Coates, is a professor of psychology at Eastern Washington University, which is near where the Abbey is. And so we wrote it together. So he brings the psychological viewpoint. So it's quite interesting. And in that way, it's something that you can give to your friends that aren't Buddhist. You know, they're not going to go, oh, you're trying to convert me. you know, because that's not what's going on with the book. Okay. But since this is a Buddhist group, then this weekend we'll be talking about it, you know, more from a Buddhist viewpoint. And I say this because when Russell and I were writing the book, you know, he's from a scientific background, I'm from a Buddhist background. We have many things in common, but we also have certain differences. So when he started talking too much about the brain, you know, and the brain, you know, this area of the brain and that area of the brain and emotions coming from the brain, I kind of went, you know, and when I started talking about rebirth and, you know, tendencies coming from previous lives, then he went, So, but eventually we worked it out, you know, and it turned out okay. But since he isn't here, when we come to those parts about the brain, then I'll give the refutation. We've done programs together, and it's a lot of fun because we have a lot of respect for each other and can debate about things, yeah, in a friendly way. So we will start, you know, with the prayers this morning. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about them and how to think. So the reason we do recitations at the beginning is to change the way we're thinking and, you know, because you might have been coming here, you know, thinking about what's going on at home and trying to find a parking place and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, we want to change our mind and do something more serious. So we start with taking refuge, which is making a statement about the direction we're taking in our spiritual practice and who our guides are. Okay? The reason we do this is to clarify it for ourselves. You know, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha don't need us to take refuge in them, but we need to clarify for ourselves what our spiritual path is and who's leading us along that path. Okay? So we take refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. The Dharma being the last two of the four noble truths, true cessations and true paths. And they're the real, the actual Dharma refuge, because when we actualize them in our mind, then our mind becomes liberated. Yeah, and liberation is from samsara is the point of the whole thing. So, you know, that Dharma refuge, the wisdom, the true path, which is the wisdom realizing emptiness that overcomes the ignorance, and the ignorance is what binds us in cyclic existence. Then by practicing that wisdom, overcoming the ignorance, we attain nirvana, or true cessations. Yeah, the cessations of dukkha, or unsatisfactory experiences, and also its causes. Yeah, so the Dharma is the real refuge that we turn to, and then the Buddha is the one who taught the Dharma. The Sangha are the ones who have actualized it and experienced it. So the Sangha jewel that we take for refuge is not just any old person. It's somebody who's realized directly, non-conceptually, the nature of reality. And I say this, you know, specify exactly what the Sangha refuge is, because nowadays, at least in the US, you know, and I think some places in Europe, people use the word Sangha in a very non-traditional way, referring to anybody who comes to a Buddhist center. Yeah, is it used that way here? Yeah, so then this becomes the Sangha. Actually, that's not the usual way the word is used, okay? The usual way, the actual scriptural meaning, the Sangha jewel we take refuge in, like I said, is somebody who's realized emptiness directly. And then the representative of that Sangha Dual is a community of four or more fully ordained monastics. Okay? And it has to be a community, not just an individual. Yeah, because there's something very special that happens when you have a group of monastics in a place. Calling everybody who comes to the Dharma Center Sangha is very confusing, because then people say, well, I take refuge in the Sangha. And they kind of look around. And you know, people who come to the Dharma Center aren't necessarily even Buddhists. So they look around, and I take refuge. And you know, this guy's sleeping with somebody else who isn't his wife, and that one's drinking and drugging, and you know, this one lies through his nose, and I'm taking refuge in these people? You know, that doesn't make sense, does it? You know, we need a good example to be our refuge. Yeah? So that's the problem, I think, with calling a Buddhist community, you know, a Dharma center, a Sangha, because it doesn't really serve the purpose of the Sangha. Okay, so that's who we're taking refuge in. Then why are we taking refuge in them? Yeah, why are we turning to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as our spiritual guides? Yeah, because we're a mess. Okay? I mean, this is one of the first things you have to get used to in Buddhism, acknowledging that you're a mess and that you're wrong. You know, this, as long as we think I've got it all right and I know the truth, then we can't learn anything. Yeah? So they always say that you know, the grass doesn't grow on the mountain peaks, it only grows in the valleys. Yeah. So people who are very arrogant, saying, I've got it all together, I'm liberated, I'm this and that, they're the tall mountain peaks. The grass of the Dharma doesn't grow there, you know, but it grows in the lower valleys. So when we get used to recognizing, you know, that we're not know-it-alls and that we need some help, that we're trapped in cyclic existence and, you know, it's not a very pleasant situation overall, then that makes us more open to the teachings. So we turn for refuge not only because we need the help, okay, but also because we see that we have great potential, that we have the ability to become fully awakened Buddhas. That we don't have to be limited sentient beings forever. Yeah. And in fact, we really aspire to become fully awakened Buddhas because we have compassion for all other living beings, because we realize that we're all in the same boat. You know, all of us are afflicted by ignorance, you know, other afflictions like attachment and confusion and anger, jealousy, pride, all these kinds of things, and that we take rebirth again and again under the force of our polluted actions or karma. So we realize that, you know, all of us need help. We, you know, that we're all seeking some kind of state of secure happiness and fulfillment. And that we really don't know how to bring it about, because we've been trying to get there our whole lives, doing everything under the sun, trying to be happy, and it hasn't worked. Yeah? And so we're turning to the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, the Buddha being the fully awakened one, the Sangha being the ones who've seen the ultimate nature directly, you know, and are well along the path. So we're turning to them for guidance, because we need their help, and because we aspire to be like them so that we can give the same help and benefit to other living beings. Okay? So this is definitely a path of opening our heart to other living beings. You know, it's not a path of, you know, I'm going to get myself out of samsara, out of cyclic existence, and ciao, Adios, good luck. You know, I hope you get out at some time, but I'm going to Nirvana. Okay, so it's not like that. Rather, we feel, you know, a very strong connection to other living beings, you know, because we see their kindness and we see their misery, and we don't feel right about just doing something for our own benefit. You know, it just doesn't feel right inside to do that, because we've received so much help and benefit from others. Okay, so the last two lines, the first two of the first verse, I take refuge until I am awakened in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's taking refuge. And then, by the merit I create by practicing generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain by engaging in generosity, isn't it? Yeah, engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. That's why we want to practice, you know, why we're turning to the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha for refuge. And so this is very good, you know, to do at the beginning of every day and every practice session, reaffirming the direction we're taking, reaffirming our motivation. Okay? And so this is, you know, last night we talked about the force of motivation. We also talked about the force of aspiration. So here we're aspiring to become Buddha for the benefit of others. And we also talked about the force of familiarity. So by chanting this, you know, every day, many times, you know, and before each session, then we're becoming very familiar with refuge and bodhicitta. You know, putting that as a deep imprint in our mind. And it's one short verse, but you could spend decades explaining the meaning of it. Yeah, I mean, it really contains everything in it. And the thing is, at the time we die, you know, it's so important at the time of death that we have a virtuous mental state, because that will really help virtue, you know, the seeds of virtuous karma to ripen. So if we can have strong refuge at the time of death, if we can have bodhicitta, you know, this altruistic intention at the time of death, then for sure we will have a good rebirth. Yeah, for sure. Because if you have a virtuous intention, it's going to make good karma ripen, you know. And of course, to have that virtuous intention at the time of death, we have to practice and be habituated with cultivating it during our life. So in the process of doing that, we've created a lot of virtuous karma, which is the force of the white seed. You see how the how these forces are, the five forces, like really permeate our practice? Okay, so if we can remember the meaning of this prayer as we're dying, it's like hugely, enormously beneficial. Yeah. And, you know, you can really see that, because some people, how many of you have been with people when they've died? Yeah, a number of you. Yeah. So some people kind of go peacefully, and some people it's difficult. Yeah? They really struggle. And they're very afraid. They're not ready to go. They're clinging. They're grasping. Yeah? And they're scared out of their minds. Yeah? And so many people die like that. And they, you know, they don't really have a spiritual refuge. And that makes their death really difficult, which in turn makes the future life more difficult. Whereas if we're able to have very strong refuge in the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, and a strong altruistic intention for others, then when we die, we feel like our life has been made meaningful. Yeah, we've had a meaningful life. We've cultivated positive attitudes. We've done something good in our life. And we're prepared to die because we've been studying the Buddha's teachings. We know that everything's impermanent. We know that death is certain. Its time is uncertain. And we know that we can't take anything with us at the time of death except our karma and our, you know, that we've created and these mental habits. That people and our body and material possessions, all these things stay behind. So there's no sense clinging to them, you know, because we can't take them with. So then that just enables that kind of background that we've practiced in our life enables death to be much smoother. And then especially when we're able to generate the attitudes of refuge and bodhicitta when we're dying, that puts our mind in a really positive state, you know, where we're saying, okay, I dedicate all the merit from this life, which is the power of aspiration, the force of aspiration, the fourth power. You know, I dedicate all the merit from this life, and I also aspire in the future life to meet fully awakened teachers, you know, who are fully qualified and can lead me on the Mahayana Vajrayana path. I aspire to meet the Dharma when I'm young and have the mental presence to recognize, you know, good teachers and to recognize the importance of the Dharma when I'm young so I can start to practice. I aspire in my future lives also to keep good ethical conduct, to generate bodhicitta, and basically to continue where we left off in this life. Yeah? And so if you die with that kind of aspiration, I mean, that's really nice, isn't it? Yeah? You feel fulfilled about this life, you feel optimistic about the next life, you know what you want to do, your mind is completely virtuous, and then you let go. Yeah, and you just go on to your next life. And one of my teachers compared that process to a bird who takes off flying from a ship. You know, the ship's in the middle of the ocean. The bird just takes off and it flies. You know, it doesn't like, and that's like, because when death comes, you know, we gotta go. You know, what are you gonna do? Who are you going to complain to and say, sorry, I need some more time, I'm not ready yet, you know. Let me get dressed and put on my makeup and, you know, do everything that I've always wanted to do but never done. You know, you can't complain to anybody, yeah. So when we die, we got to take off like that bird, yeah. And the bird just goes, you know. I mean, the bird just goes. It isn't going like, I've got to hang on to this ship, you know. I don't want to leave. And then when it finally flies, it isn't looking back. My friends, my relatives, I don't want to leave them. I want to go back. The bird doesn't have that inner torment. And so likewise, when we die, we don't want to have that inner torment either, do we? Yeah, we want to just take off and know where we're going and have a positive mental state. Mm-hmm. So really practicing and internalizing the meaning of just even these four lines in our life is tremendously valuable. Yeah. And then, you know, to remember them at the time of death. And if we don't think we can remember, tell our friends, tell our family. If they're with us when we're dying, read this to us. Remind us of our practice. So, yeah, very valuable to do like this. Okay. Then the next four lines. Okay, may all sentient beings have happiness in its causes. That's love. So that's the definition of love. Wanting someone to have happiness in its causes. Notice, it isn't, I want someone to have happiness in its causes because they're my friend, they're my relative, They're nice to me. They support me when I feel down. They praise me. They tell me how wonderful I am. They take care of me when I'm sick. They don't upset me. They don't disagree with me. They aren't obnoxious towards me. They also hate the same people I do. You know, love is not any of that, okay? Love is just, I want sentient beings to have happiness and the causes of happiness. Yeah. Now there's the whole question of what is happiness and what are the causes of happiness. That's a whole other discourse. You know, maybe we'll remind me, we'll get to that, okay? It's a huge topic. Yeah, because we usually think, you know, well, let's go to the second line. Otherwise, I'll get off on that. You know, we'll talk about the prayers the whole weekend and never get to. Okay, then the second one is, may all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. So that is the definition of compassion, wanting somebody to be of suffering and its causes. Okay. And that brings up the question of what is suffering? Mm-hmm. Another huge question. Because yeah. First of all, suffering is not a very good translation for the Pali and Sanskrit word dukkha, which is actually the word that the Buddha used. Dukkha means unsatisfactory conditions. Yeah. That is different than suffering, isn't it? The word suffering connotes like, ouch, you know, I'm suffering physical suffering or very gross mental suffering. Okay. That everybody can understand is undesirable. That's what suffering means. Dukkha, it has a much broader meaning. Yeah? Dukkha actually includes samsaric happiness. Yeah? That what we call happiness in a worldly way is also included in dukkha, which is translated as suffering here. Why? Yeah? Why is that called dukkha? Why is that unsatisfactory? Because whatever worldly happiness we have, first of all, it doesn't last. Yeah. And second of all, by its very nature, it isn't pleasurable. Okay? Meaning that those activities are pleasurable only for a short while when they're in the process of alleviating a bigger suffering. But if we do those same activities continually without break, they themselves become painful. Okay? So take something like, What is something that everybody in Denmark likes to do besides drink Carlsberg? Okay, give me some other example.
Sunshine.
Oh, yes, sunshine. Okay, yes. Yeah, the rare commodity here, I've noticed. Okay, so on a normal day, like today, it's like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if there was sunshine? It's so miserable out. It's cold. It's cloudy. It's raining. I don't like the weather. Yeah. Then the next day there's sunshine. Wow. This is fantastic. You know, it's still 10 degrees out, but you put on your bathing suit. You know, because the sun's out, and you know, you want to go out in the sun, and you say, this is happiness, this is delightful. Okay, but it's delightful because it's alleviating the misery of the clouded days. If you were in the sunshine, you know, all day, all night, without any break, you couldn't go inside, you know, and it's very bright sunshine, would that continue to be happy? No. After a while, it was like, I want to go inside. I need some shade. Okay? So then you go inside, and then the cloudiness is a relief, and the cloudiness is happiness, because it's alleviating the pain of too much sunshine. So you see, the sunshine, by its own nature, isn't blissful. We call it happiness simply because it's alleviating the pain of the overcast days. Okay? Same with eating. When we're hungry, food alleviates the pain of hunger. But if we continue to eat and eat and eat, what happens? You know, we get a tummy ache. So eating itself is not in the nature of true happiness, because if we keep doing it, it makes us, it creates pain. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Could we say that the combination of hunger and eating is happiness? The combination of sunshine and cloud is happiness?
Yeah, many people ask that. They say, you know, don't we need suffering in order to know what happiness is? We always say that when we're not in a state of big suffering. As soon as we're in a state of big suffering, do we say we need suffering to know what happiness is? No. Okay? So, in Buddhism, what we're doing is we're thinking in a very different way than normal society thinks in this way. And we're saying, you know, suffering is suffering. Who needs it? If there's a way to transcend it altogether, then let's do that. Yeah? We don't need to keep suffering in order to know what happiness is. The memory of suffering is sufficient. Okay? Yeah? So compassion here is opening our heart and, you know, connecting with the misery of others, not only the painful, the dukkha of pain, but also the dukkha of change, which is worldly happiness. And then an even deeper level of dukkha is what's called the dukkha of pervasive conditioning. And what this means is that we have a body and mind that are under the influence of ignorance. Yeah? We don't usually think of ourselves as having a body and mind under the influence of ignorance, do we? In fact, do we ever think, how often have you wondered, you know, why am I alive and why am I who I am? Have you ever wondered that? You know, probably when we were kids. Yeah, and then we grow up and we get too busy looking for pleasure. We forget about it. But actually, it's a very good question. Why are we alive? And what happens after we die? And why do I have a body to start with? And why do I have a body that gets old and sick and dies? And I remember as a teenager, you know, asking people these kind of questions. And nobody could give me a good answer. You know? I went to different religious leaders and asked them these kind of questions. And, you know, like, why is there suffering? You know, the answer was, God wanted us to learn something. And then I said, why? If God created us, why didn't he create us smarter? Yeah, why do we have to suffer in order to learn something? And then they usually answered, just have faith. This is a mystery. Just have faith. Well, it was way too mysterious for me, I tell you. You know? And I couldn't handle, you know, any of that. It didn't make any sense to me. Okay? So you come along to Buddhism and you know, well, why do I have a body that gets old and sick and dies? Well, because we have a mind that under the influence of ignorance craves to have a body. Why do we crave to have a body? Because of ignorance. Yeah, because we don't know the ultimate nature, because we don't understand that craving brings suffering. Yeah. Is there a way to get rid of ignorance? Or are we doomed with it forever? Yeah. Well, there's a way to get rid of it. How? Realize, you know, ignorance is a faulty mind. What it apprehends doesn't exist. If you realize, generate wisdom that realizes things as they are, it knows the opposite of what ignorance apprehends, and so it can obliterate ignorance. Well, what about God? We don't need God. You know, from a Buddhist viewpoint, God doesn't exist. If you're defining God as some kind of permanent creator. Because there's too many logical fallacies that arise if you think that we were created by some kind of permanent creator, manager of the universe. Yeah? Because I remember also being a kid, and you know, I was brought up to believe in God, and I said, well, why did God create us? God was lonely. I thought God was perfect. If you're perfect, how can you be lonely? Yeah? Okay. You said God was permanent, you know, but who created God? Well, God's always been there. He's permanent. He doesn't change. Well, if he doesn't change, then how can he create anything? Because creation involves changing, doesn't it? Yeah, if God doesn't change, then how can God create? And did God create heaven and hell? Why in the world would he do that? You say he's compassionate. Why would a compassionate God create the universe that includes hell and creates ignorant sentient beings that he then sends to hell? That doesn't sound very compassionate to me. You know? I mean, this is what I was asking as a kid, and that's why by the time I went to college, to university, I just decided, you know, forget organized religion. It just doesn't make any sense, you know. So which is why I like Buddhism, because when I went to my first Buddhist course, the Lama said, you don't need to believe anything we say. Good. Good. Now I'll listen to you. Yeah? They weren't threatening me with going to hell because I didn't believe. Yeah. They didn't tell me that they had a truth and, you know, the only truth. They just said, come and listen. Think about it yourself. See if it helps you when you practice it. And decide for yourself. And I thought that was quite reasonable. Okay, let's get back to the four immeasurables. It looks like I'm talking about the prayers we're doing before the session, for the entire session, doesn't it? My teacher does this. I guess that's why I'm his disciple. Because he'll start off with the motivation for the talk. He'll do the motivation for whatever it is, you know, for like everything, but the last 10 minutes, and then the last 10 minutes he'll talk about the topic. Okay, it could be worse, huh? Then may all sentient beings not be separated from sorrowless bliss. This is immeasurable joy. And so this is a mind that rejoices at others' virtue, at others' good qualities, at others' opportunities. Yeah, so it's a joyful mind. It's the opposite of jealousy, which we'll talk about a little later. And then may all sentient beings abide in equanimity free of bias, attachment, and anger. So that's equanimity, and that's a mind that is free from attachment to friends, aversion to people we don't like, and apathy towards everybody else. Okay? So equanimity is kind of the basis for genuine love and compassion, because if we can have equanimity towards all beings, then it's possible to really open our heart to all of them and to wish all of them well. If we don't have equanimity, if we're partial, if we're biased, if we're prejudiced, then we want to help some beings and harm others. And if we have that mind that wants, that plays favorites, that helps some and harm others, then basically we're no better than animals. Yeah, when you think of it, how many of you have pets at home? Yeah, do your, mostly dogs? Yeah, dogs, cats, birds, okay. Pigs now, some people keep pigs as pets. You know? But your pets love you, don't they? Yeah? But when they see somebody they don't know, what do? They usually bark. Yeah, or they make a fuss. So they like their friends, they harm their enemies. If we human beings are like that, then we're doing the same thing, aren't we? Help our friends, harm our enemies. You know, I think with human intelligence, we have more potential than that. Yeah. And I think that's why really serious meditation on equanimity is quite important, you know, because it shows us we can actually free our mind from this kind of bias and prejudice. And you can really see the damage that bias and prejudice have. You know, on a personal view, you know, in a personal way, when we favor some and we can't stand others, then we're continuously on pins and needles. We don't feel consistently comfortable around people. Yeah, because we want to be with these people. And we don't want to be with those people. So emotionally, we become like a yo-yo. Oh, I like these people. I feel good. Ugh, I don't like that one. I feel bad. Yeah? So emotional yo-yo. I love you. I hate you. I love you. I hate you. It's exhausting. Yeah? So what we're getting at equanimity is not apathy. It's not, oh, okay, I don't like some and hate some, so I don't care about anybody. You know, that's not it, because apathy is also quite an unrealistic state of mind. By equanimity, it's an open-hearted care and concern for others. Okay, and we have care and concern for them because they're just like us. They want to be happy and not suffer. That's it. Not, as I was saying before, I care about them because they're nice to me and they agree with my political opinions. And I don't care about these because they swear at me and call me names and get in my way. Yeah, it's not like that. It's an equal-hearted care and concern for everybody. So we recite the four immeasurables and contemplate them. Usually when we do the recitations, We don't, you know, there's different ways of doing them. We can do them very slowly, where we stop after each line and contemplate it, or we just go through quickly, which forces us to really focus on the meaning of each thing as we're saying it. Yeah. So there's different ways of saying the prayers. Okay, so why don't we do the prayers now, followed by some silent meditation. The seven-limb prayer and the Buddha's mantra, I'll explain next session, how about? Okay, so at least we get somewhere this time. Okay. So the first verse, we have a tune in English that you'll catch on to. The other verses we just read. And when we recite these, we visualize in the space in front of us the Buddha surrounded by all the other Buddhas, Bodhisattvas. And we imagine ourselves surrounded by all sentient beings. And we think that we're leading all the sentient beings in taking refuge, in generating bodhicitta, in thinking in all these virtuous ways. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching meditude, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. I take refuge until I have awakened in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. By the merit I create, by engaging in generosity and the other far-reaching practices, may I attain Buddhahood in order to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free of suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from sorrowless bliss. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free of bias, attachment, and anger. Reverently I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind, and make clouds of every type of offering, actual and mentally transformed. I confess all my destructive actions accumulated since beginningless time, and rejoice in the virtues of all holy and ordinary beings. These remain until cyclic existence ends, and turn the wheel of Dharma for sentient beings. I dedicate all the virtues of myself and others to the Great Awakening. Then when we say the Buddha's mantra, imagine light coming from the Buddhas and all the Bodhisattvas into you and all the sentient beings. And it purifies you, brings all the realizations of Tayata Muni Muni Maha Muni Asoha Tayata Muni Muni Maha Muni Asoha Tayata Muni Muni Maha Muni Asoha. Either at the upper lip, the nostrils, or at your belly, and observing the breath. bodhicitta and motivation. Have the long-term aspiration to become a fully awakened Buddha, so that we'll have the qualities and abilities necessary to be of the most effective benefit to each and every living being. And in order to learn the path and get some experience in practicing it, then we will listen to the Dharma and practice it together here today. Okay, so I'll start off here with a chapter that Russell wrote, actually, and in it he was discussing the three types of, what does he call them? Systems, I think it is. Yeah, three types of systems of emotions. So one is the threat system. The second one is, I want to get his terminology right, if it's drive, yeah, the drive system. And the third is the safety system. Okay, I think that's the terminology he used. Yeah.
What was number two?
Okay, threat system, drive system, and safeness system. Of safety system. Okay, so he's saying that these are three emotional systems, a way that psychologists kind of talk about us human beings. And the threat system is what's activated when we feel danger. You know, we feel threatened physically, emotionally, so the threat system gets activated. And when we feel threatened, then it, you know, we want to strike back at what threatens us. So we strike back physically or verbally, or we want to flee from the situation. So the threat system is very much related to the anger response. Remember, we talked about that anger yesterday and the different kinds of behavior that can come from anger. Okay? The threat system, according to psychologists and evolutionary biologists, we have because of evolution, you know, because we came from monkeys and different life forms, and we were just trying to stay alive physically, you know. So when a tiger's chasing you, then your threat system gets activated, the adrenaline goes, and you run, hopefully faster than the tiger. Okay. They say, I think that the amygdala, one part in the brain, you know, has a lot to do with the threat system. It gets activated when we feel insecure, endangered, fear. Okay. So I find that rather interesting, you know, that how much scientists correlate that with different areas in the brain and also with hormonal responses and, you know, also with the rest of our body, because our muscles then get ready to run or to, you know, beat somebody up or whatever it is. Yeah. So there's a very much a physical response often from the threat system. Now, from a Buddhist viewpoint, that physical response is not the emotional response. Yeah, remember we were talking yesterday The emotional response is the anger. The behavior is something different. So they're related when we're alive. What's going on in the body, you know, with the adrenaline going and the amygdala doing its thing and, you know, whatever other areas in our brain are activated. That's happening on one level. But on a feeling level, a conscious level, there's an emotion. Okay? So there's some correlation. But I don't think we can say that the emotion is that response in the brain. And I don't think we can say that the chemical, electrical things in the brain cause the emotion. Okay? Why do I say this? Okay? See, I'm starting with the points that Russell and I had some different views on, okay? Because from a Buddhist viewpoint, the body and the mind are different natures. The body is physical in nature. We can touch it, we can discern it using our senses, and it also can be examined by scientific instruments. Our mind, on the other hand, is not our brain. It's the part of us that cognizes, experiences, feels, perceives, okay? It's everything that is on the level of consciousness, of, you know, actively engaging with objects. Yeah. So the mind is something formless. It's not made of atoms and molecules. It can't be examined under a microscope or measured using different scientific instruments that talk about, you know, the dopamine or whatever chemicals it is and the synapses and all these kinds of things, okay? So there's some correlation, yeah, on a gross level. When we feel certain emotions, there's some correlation in the brain and the nervous system. But the two systems are very different. One's material in nature, the other is not material in nature. And it's the mind is clear and cognizant, meaning that it has the ability to reflect objects and to engage in objects. Okay. When there's a corpse there, the brain is still there. Yeah, the mind is no longer there. So the presence or absence of the mind, of the consciousness, is what determines whether there's a living being or a corpse. No? And many of you who've been with people who have died or after they've died, there's a big difference, isn't there? A huge difference between when somebody's alive and when there's simply the body there. The body is not the person. And there's no cognizance in the body. You know, there's no awareness once the mind has left. Yeah. The mind doesn't always leave immediately. Sometimes, depending upon the level of spiritual realization, it may take some time to leave. But once the mind has left, you know, then the body is just, it gets recycled in nature. Yeah, it came from material causes, the sperm and egg of our parents and all the food we've eaten. Yeah, when death comes, it gets recycled into material causes, you know, and the worms have a good lunch. Yeah, the mind, on the other hand, is a totally different nature. And when we look, even in this life, one moment of mind, of consciousness, comes from the previous moment, which comes from the previous moment. And so we trace back one moment of awareness, of clarity and cognizance. We can trace it back to the time when we were infants. So even we don't remember when we were infants, we know that babies had consciousness. We can look at babies now, And we see they have consciousness. So I think it's reasonable to infer we also did when we were a baby. If we didn't, then we would have already been dead and long ago buried, okay? So one moment of mind comes from the previous mind, and this continuity of consciousness goes back into the womb also. Yeah. So even in the womb, once, conception has occurred, because conception is the sperm and egg and consciousness coming together. Yeah. The sperm and egg can come together and not have consciousness. And in that case, there's no pregnancy. It gets passed out. But when the consciousness enters, then, it starts to multiply. The cells start to multiply. And you get a living being. And the consciousness in the womb, of course, is a very rudimentary consciousness. No language, no sophisticated thinking. But there's still the experience of pleasure and pain in the womb, okay? And the baby's moving around. You know that, yeah? Okay, so so the continuity of consciousness, we can trace it back to the moment of conception. But where did that first moment come from? The previous moment of mind, which was the mind before it entered this body. So it was in an intermediate state, and before that it was in another body. Similarly, the body and mind are together during life. When they separated at death, the body has its continuity, the mind has its continuity, and it goes ahead. And in the case of ordinary beings whose minds are under the influence of ignorance, then it gets reborn in another life. Okay? Because there's one moment of clarity and cognizance that follows another moment of clarity and cognizance. Okay? So they're different natures. So while the science usually thinks of the threat system as having a lot to do with our body, and certainly there's a biological response, okay? From the Buddhist perspective, why when we feel threatened do we react with fear, with attachment to our body, with anger at whatever it is that's threatening to us? Yeah, from a Buddhist viewpoint, we wouldn't say it's just a biological knee-jerk response because we came from animals. Yeah. We would say that it's due to self-grasping. Last night we spoke about self-grasping ignorance, the mind that solidifies everything, that makes everything seem very concrete and having its own independent nature. So when there's the identity of I, and I am in danger, or what is mine is in danger, then because we're attached to I, we're attached to mine, then we become fearful, we become angry, we have fight and flight, and the body joins in. With the amygdala and the hormonal system and all these other things, the brain doing its thing. And that's how we get the biological response. Okay? So it's kind of coming at this, event of there's a mental feeling with a biological response. Coming, Buddhists come at it from the viewpoint of the mind. And the scientists come at it from the viewpoint of evolution and us coming from animals. Yeah, and the amygdala being a very ancient part of the brain. This difference in viewpoint, I think is related also to whether you accept rebirth or not. Because if you say that the mind is the brain, okay, then you're making the mind into something material. And when the brain ceases, then the mind ceases, which means at the time of death, there is nothing that continues. And it would also mean that at the time of conception, somehow consciousness began. Yeah, because from a scientific view, you just have the sperm and egg. So where do you get the mind if you just have the sperm and egg? Yeah. So then some scientists say, well, the mind is an emergent property of the brain. I've never quite understood what they mean by emergent property. Somehow they're trying to establish a causal relationship between the mind, which is the brain, which is physical, and the mind, which is not physical. Yeah.
But they think it is physical. That's the problem.
Yeah.
So they don't accept that there's nothing that's not physical.
Physical, right. It's a very reductionist kind of thing. So then that makes the mind and the brain the same thing. Yeah. Which means that our mind would come from the sperm and egg, which would mean that our parents really lost their mind when they had us. Yeah? Wouldn't it? They lost their sperm and egg, so they lost part of their mind. Yeah? Yeah. So it makes things a bit difficult. That way, you know, but then it also is very strange, because if that were the case, if the mind were completely physical and the brain, then identical twins would have the same mind. They don't. Okay? Also, those of you who are parents, when you have a newborn child, does your newborn have a personality? Yes. You bet they do. Yes. Yeah, if you have more than one kid, did your kids have the same personality when they were a day old or 2 days old? Mm-mm. Yeah, every single parent tells me this. Yeah, that we don't come in as blank slates. We come in with tendencies, with predispositions, yeah, some kind of habit energy. Okay, this is, from a Buddhist viewpoint, coming from the mental habits and the actions we created in previous lives. If you say that the mind and the brain are both the material thing, where do you get these differences in habits and tendencies from? Yeah. Do you say that they're in the genes? Can you look at a gene and say this is the tendency for optimism? Yeah. Do you look at a brain and think it's the person? If the mind and the brain were the same thing, yeah, then the person would be the brain. Then when you say, I love you, dear, you're referring to their brain, which would mean, as we talked about the other day, if their brain were out here on a table, oh, I love you, brain. You're so wonderful. Do you love somebody's brain? Is their personality their brain? Do you look at a brain and see a personality? Do you look at synapses in the brain and see a person? No. So this is why, you know, we say that the mind and the brain are different natures. There's something else going on here. We can't reduce everything to material. So I think somehow in our society we've gotten so materially oriented. And of course material has to do with our sense consciousnesses, doesn't it? So we're always, you know, activated externally with our senses, thinking everything, everything comes down to material. And I think that, you know, why science has made many advances, and I think this relationship between the mind and the brain is very interesting. And, you know, and certainly when people have chemical imbalances that cause mental illness, taking meds can be very helpful. So while I'm accepting of all of that, I don't think you can say they're the same thing. And I think there's danger in saying they're the same thing. The danger being that then whenever we have problems, we attribute it to something physical, something genetic. Okay? Why am I an alcoholic? Because I have alcoholic genes. That means there's nothing I can do about my alcoholism. It runs in the family. It's determined by the genes. I can't get rid of my genes. So I have no responsibility at all for being an alcoholic. Is that a helpful attitude to have? No. Yeah. And it can actually lead to some really serious social repercussions, yeah, whereby, you know, the law wants to check everybody's genes and maybe abort certain children because they have certain genes, yeah, or kill certain babies because they have certain things going on in their synapses. Yeah, that begins to border on Nazism. Is it, doesn't it? You know, some kind of, then there's superior people with superior genes, which of course is my group, whatever group you belong to. Yeah, your genes are always superior. You know, my philosophy about human beings, first we decide what we believe, then we look for the scientific evidence and scriptural evidence to support what we believe. And you'll always find something. Yeah? And you can juggle data and science. Yeah? So, yeah. Okay, so while this talk of the threat system is interesting, I prefer to look at it from a more psychological viewpoint of it being anger, you know, that's based on fear and attachment, something like that, and then approaching, remedying it through the different methods that the Buddha talks about for calming our mind and eliminating fear, eliminating attachment, eliminating hurt. Okay? If we don't do that, then we're still in the stage of waiting for scientists to come up with the happy pill. Yeah? So when you're angry, you take a pill to get rid of your anger. Yeah? When you're jealous, you take a jealous pill. It becomes rather scary, doesn't it? Okay, then the drive system. Yeah, the drive system wants to accomplish something. Okay, it wants to get something. So, in a way, we can correlate. I don't want to say they're exactly the same, but there could be a correlation between craving and clinging attachment on one hand and the drive system on the other. Because the drive wants something. OK? okay? I want to have a career. I want I want possessions. I want money. I want social status. I want praise and approval. I, you know, want to be victorious. I want, you know? And so we're driven to accomplish what we want. So the drive system in this way, you know, in a worldly way, we say it's quite good because that's how we improve things and make society better. Just as we say the threat system is good because it protects us from danger. And the only caveats we have are the drive system is good, but if you overdo it, then it becomes greed. And the threat system is helpful, but if you overdo it, it becomes violence, you know, indiscriminate violence. Okay? Then there's the safe system. And the safety system is when we feel peaceful, relaxed, safe, yeah? When we're content with who we are and what we do. And so here the safety system is seen as something very positive because we feel good, you know. We're not, the ambition is gone, the extreme drive is gone, the extreme threat system is gone, and we feel safe, we can communicate with others, we can share emotionally with others, we can have compassion and love and so forth, okay? So that's kind of how the psychologists see it, you know? The first two systems are helpful, but don't overdo them. And the third system is pretty good, but again, don't overdo that because then maybe you're just too relaxed all the time and you don't accomplish enough, okay? You know, from a Buddhist viewpoint, when I look at it, you could say, you know, maybe the drive system, I'm just sharing my thoughts here, could be affiliated with craving and clinging, you know, which are certainly detrimental. But the drive system could also be wanting the aspiration system, yeah? When we practice the Dharma, we have a certain drive, you could call it, to purify our mind, to create merit, to gain some peace of mind, to develop honesty and friendship and ethical conduct. You know, we have all these aspirations and things that we want to accomplish. Yeah. So you could see the drive system from that viewpoint, you know, also. So maybe like the scientists, some good things, some not so good things. Of course, from a Buddhist viewpoint, what the drive system is aimed at is very different than from the scientific system, what the drive system aims at, you know. And then maybe the safety system could be when you're in deep states of samadhi, and single-pointedness, and the mind is very focused and concentrated and deeply peaceful. It isn't all scattered with distractions and all sorts of discursive thought. That might be the safety system from the Buddhist viewpoint. Or also when we have love and compassion, joy and equanimity just in our daily life, then there's no feeling of having to protect ourselves from harm. We feel safe and secure within ourselves, okay? So just some thoughts on you know, how the psychologist, one way psychologists break down emotional responses and how it fits into Buddhism. I really need to stop now so we can have some meditation. Okay, so let's stop. And then when we come back, I'll continue with this, okay?